All right, let's go ahead and get started. If anyone would like to speak on one of the topics tonight, please fill out a blue card back of the room and bring it up to Miss Vicky, and she will get it up here to us. Okay, number two, presentation, Orange County 91 improvements kit.
The Orange County Transportation Authority is going to be implementing some improvements to State Route 91. Just at the westerly end of our city and out into Orange County. So we have invited Fernando Chaviera here today from the Orange County Transportation Authority to give us a summary and some more details also of the project. Fernando.
Thank you, Mr. Field. Mr. Mayor, council members, good afternoon to all of you. As Kip shared, my name is Fernando Chavarria, and I serve in the OCTA Department of External Affairs. A couple of weeks ago, we reported a little bit on our 91 projects to your infrastructure committee, and you were all kind enough to invite us back, and so we wanted to provide you with that same presentation to give you sort of a snapshot of what OCTA is doing along the 91 everywhere throughout Orange County, in fact. We certainly hope that this is the first of several presentations to come. As you know, in just a few short weeks, we are going to start construction on the 241 to 71 new eastbound lane. And we hope that as that project unfolds, we'll have the opportunity to come back periodically to provide you with updates. I'd like to draw your attention to the slide in front of you or on the screen. Again, this is a snapshot of some work that we're doing all up and down the corridor. Some of it is not close to Corona, but as you know, the 91 is a very vital corridor, not only to commuters, but to the movement of goods and to business. From left to right or from west to east, the projects are shaded in different colors. They are not obviously continuous. But we have identified key spots along the corridor where improvements are needed. And to that end, I'll start just briefly describing the project on the far left. It's a proposed new westbound lane from approximately State Route 57 on the east to I-5 on the west. As a result, it runs through or is adjacent to the cities of Fullerton and Anaheim. And sort of touches down on Buena Park or comes right to the foot of Buena Park. As we move to the middle of the screen, we have a second project that comes a little closer to Corona or toward the east side of the region, and it spans approximately from the 55 on the west to just shy of the 241 on the east. And lastly, the project that's about to kick off that I just referenced is a new eastbound lane from just east of the 241 to the 71, and that obviously comes into the city of Corona. That's sort of a snapshot of what we're doing all up and down the corridor. And as you all know, especially you, Councilwoman, there's a ton of work that's being done that is in one phase of development or another, whether it's in the planning phase, in the design phase, the right-of-way acquisition phase, or as in the case of the 241 to 71 project on the far right, entering the construction phase. Moving on, we wanted to give you just a closer view of each of these projects. The westbound lane project from the 57 to the 5, or vice versa, is, as I shared, in the project approval environmental document phase. There are three alternatives that are being considered. Of course, the no-build alternative is standard. There is one alternative that proposes just a single lane, and a second alternative that proposes a new general-purpose lane, as well as an auxiliary lane during along key stretches of the project limits. The estimated start of construction, if approved, is in 2013. And the estimated completion is in 2016. As we speak, the draft environmental document is being finalized, and we hope, actually this is should be revised, we hope to have a public hearing on that document in early December. And then obviously if that document moves forward, We then move in to design and so on and so forth. To date, we've been communicating with the community in a number of ways, some public meetings, and we've been doing some direct outreach to those communities that are most directly impacted. And then on the right side of the screen, you have sort of a drop-down menu, if you will, that summarizes the benefits and some of the aspects of the project. Moving to the east, here again, along the left side of the screen, you'll note that this particular project is in the design phase, so it's gone through environmental. The estimated start of construction is 2011, and the estimated completion is 2013, so you can see that they're kind of staggered. The next steps is that we need to do some additional sound wall study work. There was a reduction of funds, and so there we have to look at another way to address some sound wall issues and some noise mitigation issues. To date, there have been some public meetings and some community ascertainments preparing for when the project moves forward. And again, if I draw your attention to the drop-down menu and the map on top, you'll see that this project is most closely adjacent to Placentia, Yorba Linda, Anaheim Hills, and then comes basically to your doorstep. A new lane in each direction, both the westbound and the eastbound. Sound walls, as I said, at appropriate and necessary locations. And then obviously there will be some reconstruction or work along the bridges to allow for those lanes to move forward in their respective directions. This is just a diagram that with a legend that gives you, reminds you of what you already know, the general purpose lanes, the express lanes, the mediums, the on and off ramps. And perhaps most importantly, most relevant to this, is the project proposed lane and the auxiliary lanes in gray and in orange, respectively. The project that's about to kick off, again, is from approximately the 241 to the 71. The communities that are most adjacent to it is your own and Anaheim. It is officially in the construction phase, and it is also the first stimulus-funded project, or the largest funded project in Orange County. Recently, I think about a month ago, it was awarded to Brutico Engineering and Construction. Those of you that may be familiar with the Imperial Highway neighborhood just north of the 91 know that Brutico was awarded that contract as well. And that contract or that project has been moving forward very swiftly. Technically speaking, they're moving probably a little ahead of schedule, and we certainly hope that their performance on this upcoming project resembles the performance that they've had to date on the grade separation project along Imperial Highway. The estimated start of construction is later this month. They've already been out there. You might have seen them clearing some grub, doing some preliminary work to set the foundation. We think that K-Rail, the setting of K-Rail, so that they can do their work behind it, will start in either late November, very late November, or sometime in December. The estimated time of completion is late 2010, early 2011. And as I shared with your infrastructure committee, there are, as part of the bid, the contractor submitted a set number of days. We're going to try and just focus on finishing the project. Sometimes, there are delays, whether it be to weather or what have you, but we hope that isn't the case, and those are the estimated completion dates. To date, I think you'll be pleased to know that our outreach team has been doing some ascertainments out in the community, speaking not only to residential communities, but also to businesses, to identify their concerns, and perhaps most importantly, to identify the way in which they want to be communicated with about the project and about their traffic information needs. We've also gone to some back-to-school open houses to advise parents of the oncoming project and obviously the faculty and the staff at those respective schools. And we are here. We visited your infrastructure committee, and we'll do that with your neighboring cities as well, visiting you. And again, we hope it's periodic. The project benefits are summarized again in that drop-down menu in that sort of bluish-purple area. As we move on, this is sort of the same type of diagram, giving you the specifics. And then we wanted you to know that not just in this area, but we're kind of coding the neighborhoods to try and understand what type of land use, or, you know, whether it's residential, community, business, or what have you. And that we hope very much to be in contact with these folks, providing them with the information that they need, not only about how the project's unfolding and how their taxpayer dollars are being put to work, but how they are going to manage during construction. And on that point, I wanted to share with you that as we're building this new eastbound lane, the work will take place during the normal business day, but it will take place behind K-Rail. Most importantly, perhaps, the overwhelming majority of the work will take place during off-peak hours, rather the closures. There will be lane closures, and those quite obviously are different than full freeway closures. When there are lane closures, we'll have to take them because it is absolutely necessary, most importantly, to provide for the safety of the crews, and because it's absolutely necessary to carry out and perform the task. Full freeway closures and the lane closures will only be in the eastbound direction. And when there are full freeway closures, they will only be at the part of the beginning of the project to take away the stripes and sort of narrow down the lanes. And then again to restripe at the end of the project and to lay down the traffic detectors. I think it's important to note that the lane closures, as I said, will take place during off-peak hours. Incidentally, they coincide with the lowest cost on the 91 Express Lane, so the traffic volumes during the time that the lane closures are taking place are relatively speaking, at their absolute lowest. So the impact, technically speaking, will be at its lowest point. We've set, in terms of communication and outreach, some goals for us. We want very much to be proactively communicating. We've already done that in terms of ascertainment, trying to understand who's out there, what kind of information they need, and how they need to get it. We hope very much to increase the project awareness and the understanding, most importantly on a day-to-day basis, to provide folks with traffic information and to increase sort of the support for the project in the greater community. And we have every intention and a team in place to respond to constituent inquiries. We hope to respond to each and every one of those. Sometimes the debate or the discussion with constituents can drag on for a bit, but we have every intention to continue that discussion until it's satisfactorily addressed. The issue that they might have is satisfactorily addressed. We have prepared to communicate with folks in a number of ways, high tech, old tech. We understand that everyone gets their information or prefers their information in different ways, and this just basically lists the type of ways that we hope to communicate, including perhaps the most effective, which is on the roadway itself with electronic message boards or changeable message signs. I've seen them here in your community. It's perhaps oftentimes the most effective way to tell folks what's going on or who they can contact throughout the course of the project. This is just a slide to give you a glimpse of the fact that we're, you know, as I said, already developing a database. We have a rough understanding of the layout and of the folks that we need to communicate, stakeholders. And we also understand that this is very much, by definition, a bi-county project. We're crossing counties, and as a result, our responsibility is to communicate across those counties, in spite of the fact that it is a project that is originating in Orange County. We have invited your council, you all, and your senior officers to attend a groundbreaking ceremony next Tuesday, November the 3rd. It's a parcel that sits just west of Gypsum Canyon Road and Santa Ana Canyon Road, offers a good view of where the project will start, and we hope that you all can make it. I know that Councilmember Scott and Councilmember Montanez are going, and we certainly hope that all of you will be in attendance. We think it's going to be a great event, and we hope to have a special guest there as well. This concludes my presentation. This is just our contact information for your reference. We're at your service. We're talking with your staff, and as I said, we hope that we can come back regularly. Thank you.
Any questions? Mr. Montanez.
Thank you. And I apologize for being late. I have a couple questions. I know the 241 is not OCTA, but I thought maybe you might have an idea. A lot of people have asked that construction from Windy Point down, the extra lane and all that. Do you know what the purpose of that is?
I don't.
Okay, that's fine. I know it's not yours, so I was just curious if you did. Also, the connection on the 91 westbound to the 5 north, where that carpool lane still does not connect, is that waiting until the part you're doing there through Buena Park completes, or are you going to wait until this additional lane gets completed to make that connection?
This lane that we're talking about now?
Not this one, no.
No, you're talking about the one that's ongoing.
The 5.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a project that I'm not working on, and I couldn't confirm with certainty.
Okay. Hopefully this one you'll know.
Hopefully.
The cost on the 241, the one that we're talking about right now, the stimulus money that you're using,
sir,
for that, what's the cost? How much money is it?
The total cost for construction and construction management is estimated at 47.9.
Okay. Million, I assume.
Correct. 47.9 million. It was substantially higher many months ago. The bid that came in from Brutico was a very aggressive, very competitive bid. That brought it down. The original amount of money that was estimated for that cost has been shifted to other projects, and the original source of funds, which was Proposition 1B funds, will in due time also be shifted to other projects. 47.9 million, sir.
Okay, good. And then one last thing on one of your slides there for the partners, you still had Senator Batten in there, and it's now.
We'll correct that. Thank you kindly for pointing that out.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you.
Okay, number three. Resolution number 2009-109. Kip, this is you again.
The California High-Speed Rail Authority has initiated the environmental and engineering studies and clearance process on the Los Angeles to San Diego via the Inland Empire route. In starting that process, they have come out to a number of the communities in terms of public hearings, both to share information on the project but also to solicit input back. They were here in our community last week. They made presentations and an open house at the library, and we have some of those materials here with us today to share with you. The first is about a 5-minute video about both the content of the project and what is proposed, and then a few follow-up slides that I can explain and just provide the basic information that they presented to us. There is also a resolution before you today. Is that something you'd anticipate acting on before or after the information? Okay, we will proceed. The video will speak.
Monday
for
morning in Tokyo. It is 8 a.m. and the Shinkansen Super Express is leaving for Osaka, whisking passengers out into the countryside and making the 350-mile journey in just 2.5 hours. Every day, the scene is repeated for still more passengers across the globe. In France, from Paris to Bordeaux. In Spain, from Madrid to Barcelona. In Taiwan, from Taipei to Kaohsiung. Today, throughout the developed world, high-speed trains are a fact of everyday life for millions of people, and soon will be for millions more. Increasingly, countries are turning to high-speed trains to meet the growing transportation needs of the 21st century.
These other countries have looked at their futures and said modern high-speed rail has got to be a part of it, and an essential part of it. Without it, we can't grow, we can't prosper, we can't build the kind of society, the kind of economy that we want.
Is it reliable? Is it high-tech? Yes. Are there beautiful trains to travel on? Absolutely.
Sleek, modern, and employing the latest state-of-the-art technology, the story of high-speed trains begins nonetheless more than 50 years ago. In 1964, the first Tokaido Shinkansen left Tokyo, moving at speeds of 130 miles per hour and shuttling 100 million passengers in its first 3 years in service. It was an unparalleled success and set off a transportation revolution worldwide. In 1981, the TGV began operations in France, drawing 1 billion passengers in 20 years and revolutionizing the way Europeans travel.
Today, 12 countries throughout the world have high-speed rail systems in place, with the reach of new high-speed lines ever expanding. 8 more countries, including Mexico, Russia, and Argentina, are currently building or planning their own high-speed systems, and will soon have them up and running.
No European country, certainly not Japan, or many countries in Asia these days, would think of moving into the future without high-speed rail. I mean, they're all investing in it. Every European country, every part of the European community is investing heavily in what will be a first-class high-speed rail system that will connect the entire European community.
Today's high-speed trains are faster, quieter, and more energy efficient than ever. Today's 8th-generation Shinkansen trains routinely operate at 185 miles per hour. The French TGV now operates at 200 miles per hour in regular revenue service. China has recently opened a new train line designed for speeds of up to 217 miles per hour. And high-speed train technology has not yet reached its limits. An operational German ICE train has reached 252 miles per hour. Test runs on Japan's Shinkansen have reached 277 miles per hour. And in 2007, an experimental French TGV train reached a world record rail speed of 357 miles per hour.
Thanks to the latest improvements, it's now possible to go from downtown London to downtown Paris in 2 hours and 15 minutes. And of course, it's getting enormous ridership.
For passengers, travel on high-speed trains offers unparalleled reliability, safety, and accessibility, rivaling point-to-point travel times for air travel on trips up to 500 miles and easily outstripping travel times by automobile and conventional rail service. In the densest urban centers in the world, high-speed trains provide a complementary transportation technology that eases congestion on highways and frees capacity at increasingly crowded airports. By seamlessly integrating high-speed trains with airports and other modes of transits, such as subways, light rail, buses, and commuter rail, high-speed trains offer passengers a functional transportation alternative, while at the same time promoting sustainable development patterns within existing urban cores. Clean, electrically powered high-speed train technology also pays critical environmental dividends. One traveler's trip on a French TGV high-speed train reduces 4 to 5 times less carbon emissions than travel over the same distance by air.
Money spent today is going to go a long way in the future, and it's evidenced by the other countries that have high-speed rail. People are happier, that they're getting to work on time, they're paying less for transportation costs, and they're helping the environment. California, I believe, has to look to high-speed rail as the number one priority.
If you look at the other countries of the world that have high-speed rail systems, Japan, France, Germany, California is about the same scale, and we're approaching the same density of people. You know, France has 55, 60 million people. We're going to reach 50 million people by 2030, it's estimated.
California is perfectly fitted and set up in where the major centers of population are, where the distances are, where the people need to move.
San Francisco to Los Angeles, that's about 400 miles, 420 miles. Those are systems that lend themselves to high-speed rail.
Around the world, high-speed trains are a proven, safe, and environmentally sustainable technology for meeting the transportation needs of the 21st century. By offering a fast, frequent, and enjoyable travel alternative, high-speed trains fit in perfectly with a regional intercity transportation matrix that works. It can work in California, too.
The California High-Speed Rail project has gained a great deal of momentum over the last year with nearly $10 billion in state bonding funds that is coming their way now based on Proposition 1A. They also have recently submitted federal stimulus package applications for nearly $5 billion, and there's more money to potentially be had for the system there. So they have funding, they are moving ahead. They are moving ahead throughout the state. There are some segments of the system that are further ahead, of course, than the segment that we here sit in from Los Angeles to San Diego. However, they are spreading the monies throughout the state and working on more or less the entire system. The environmental process that they have begun will take about 4 years to complete. At the completion of that project, they will have specific alignments, specific facilities designed and environmentally cleared, ready for construction, assuming the funding is in place. Key to that process is the first 6 months, which will be an alternatives analysis. From Corona's perspective, that's a very important time because the authority is considering a number of options. If you look at the map provided right now, the purple line that starts in Los Angeles, heads out through San Bernardino, and then down through Riverside was originally identified as a preferred route coming out of the 2005 program level environmental analysis that the authority accomplished. Since that time, the authority has identified a number of concerns with regard to the feasibility of that line, and now in moving forward, they are carrying other alternatives forward to be considered at the same time. As you can see in the east to west area, there are a couple other alternatives being considered. And from a north-south perspective, an additional alternative is being considered in and along the I-15 corridor. That particular alternative would have a station option in the Corona area. We have been working as a city staff, as a coherent unit, with the authority to provide them the information that they need in identifying and studying the best location for Corona for that station and for the alignment, as well as other cities up and down the line. The authority, as I mentioned, is soliciting input right now. The city will be providing that input, and part of that is the resolution that is before you this afternoon. The input from the public or anyone else from other agencies is requested in written form to be mailed and or through email. If anyone would like further information on the project, there is a good website, the CA High Speed Rail website. Also, Public Works, certainly we will direct you to the answers to your questions if you want to get in touch with us. That concludes my presentation, unless there's any questions.
Thank you. I was just curious, on the resolution, how come we don't, as a city, we're talking about supporting the inland option, but we're not talking about supporting even the Corona option.
At this point, it is fairly early in the studies. In working with the region and the Riverside County Transportation Commission to make sure that all the options are considered and the best option for the region is selected, it might be premature necessarily to focus too much on one individual route. However, the resolution does explicitly state our support in providing all of the information and studying the route through Corona and its eventual implementation.
Yeah, I see that on the last line. My only concern is if we don't vehemently support our own option, who is? I mean, to have in one section where we support the LA to San Diego via the Inland Empire section, which is the Riverside alignment, that would then show, you know, to me that should also say in there via the Inland Empire section by way of the Corona alignment. That would be my personal.
As I stated, it may be a little premature at this point. As the studies begin to produce data, which we would expect around the March-April timeframe, we will start to be able to present data to you that is coming out of the study that would support the pros and cons of this alignment. Given the authority's evaluation criteria, we think that the alignment through Corona will fare well in that analysis, but we are pending that analysis before we put too much more information or any requests before you as far as support.
Stan.
Thank you. Mr. Field, when that study starts to arrive at a more complete form. Will that include analyses that will address approximate cost for construction, things like that, on perhaps a per mile basis or something along those lines?
Yes, it will. The studies will include information on ridership and revenue, will include information on travel times, and a comparison between the alternatives, and also capital costs. So it will go beyond just average cost per mile. It'll actually have capital cost per segment.
Okay. And with respect to the resolution that's being proposed today, in its final form, section number 5, that specifically addresses our support for the implementation and alignment of the station option within the city of Corona, that would appear above our signatures, correct?
Yes, it will.
So that it will be in its most prominent place for what we specifically address the support of.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Karen?
I think that what we're struggling with here is, just like Kip had said, we truly believe that the efficiency and effectiveness, there's no doubt that Corona is the best, that we're feeling is a better option. In the research, there are other cities that are also vying for that determination also. So we're trying to present Corona as being a team player, what's best for the region, and that's why it's more not vehemently going after saying we want it here, but rather the support of the system with the Inland Empire alignment, and then, of course, with a very subtle remark that we would support it in the city of Corona to say that we are interested in you looking over here. Because right now, we're feeling in our discussions that it's not quite time to make too strong of an effort. And I agree with you, Eugene. You know, it's one of those, we were struggling with how to do this. And
My concern, I don't want to interrupt, but and I don't disagree with trying to be a team player, but my concern is you have an identified I-215 coalition working very hard for everything on the 215, and we do not have anything on the I-15. And if you think that the I-215 coalition, who has a former California transportation commissioner as a member, is going to sit idly by while we play as a team player, I don't mind. I just don't think, unless we actively get an I-15 coalition together, we won't get this alignment. So that would be my other recommendation, is to try to put an I-15 coalition together. We've talked about it before, but, you know, if we show Ontario that we can provide more rider or more travelers to Ontario Airport than the other alignment, and other things that we can provide by using the 15 as opposed to the 215, I can guarantee it's not going to happen. So I don't oppose this resolution the way it's written. I'm just saying what the reality of the situation will be.
Stan?
Go ahead. Just to your comment, Mrs. Spiegel. I completely agree. We are a team player. There's no doubt about it. I think Corona's demonstrated that time and time again, and I think your words are excellent, counsel. I just happen to think that we should be the quarterback on this one. That's all.
Can I ask that Daryl Tower be lend some time?
As Karen's pointed out, and all of you are discussing, both very apropos points. I think what Kip was trying to illustrate is that at this point in time, where we're at in the study and just the feasibility and the EIR portion of the program, we're trying to avoid being the first out of the gate to draw in this battle of making it an us against Riverside or us against San Bernardino kind of fight, primarily because, and Kip can echo this probably more succinctly than I, we're very confident that based on Corona's geographic position, its alignment, its elevation changes or lack thereof, agency-owned properties within and around an area that would facilitate a station. We are technically a superior alignment. So rather than draw this battle into us against them at this point in time, it would probably likely be best to let the battle be more about letting the technical folks do the technical work. The answer will be the answer, because ultimately neither city is going to have a decision in it. The decision will hopefully, if it goes as planned, will be based on the technical merits of the project, because the line is so long and so expensive. Riverside's voice, we know, stronger than Corona, and everybody's resolutions to this point that are being worked on or have been presented have been of this nature, which is, as a region, we want high-speed rail, we're willing, we just perform better because of our geography, our elevation, our topography, and the fact that we have open space, agency-owned, that's in a green environment that lends itself to a TOD, any kind of transportation, whether it be high-speed rail or cars. So it's nexus to the Green Valley Initiative and the Dos Lagos project, as well as all the other pieces, I think is probably a better route than trying to go into the debate and the argument at this point in time about us over Riverside, because it's really it's a much larger question that will be solved with the answer being money.
And I would simply add to Daryl's comments to note that that is a four-year process ahead of us. This first 6 months is important to make sure that our alignment is considered in the process, but there is ample opportunity as data comes out to start building coalitions and building support, and then it will be based on fact.
So, Daryl, just a follow-up. So what you're indicating is if we let Riverside go ahead and charge forward as they apparently are, and we hold back, we don't necessarily lose ground at this point in time.
A little bit different. If Riverside charges forward as you described with a more aggressive posture and stance, we certainly will be responding appropriately with equal and probably greater force, in that our response will be similar and our geography and topography are superior. So I think Riverside has taken to this point the higher road, just as we have, which said, look, these are great alignments, we want it for the Inland Empire, but we stand ready to illustrate our presence. We've so far prepared for KIPP, and he's forwarded support from all of our local legislators, along with a support from the council and the resolution. So we're going hand in hand with them at this point in time, but they've chosen to take the high road and let the technical merits of the project stand on its own. However, should that path deviate, we're prepared and ready to go forward with more aggressive steps.
Thank you.
Okay. Bring it back to council.
My only comment is, as we're going forward, please, as you hear things, particularly when we're on a regional, I think it should be something that we do bring attention to, KIPP and myself and Daryl, because there are some issues that are contradictory to what I'm trying to do this very delicately, to what Riverside's presenting in San Bernardino. And so we have to be consistent in our word, and that's why it's very calculated on how we're presenting this, so that we are consistent and strong, and that we don't have any backpedaling that we're going to have to do at any given point. So I think that that's something that we all have to keep our ears out and stay tuned, and certainly keep in contact, because even though it's a four-year process, it's going to happen if we're not paying attention without us being a part of it. So we all have to make sure that we communicate. I think it's really going to be critical.
With that being said,
I'll move recommended action.
Okay. Please vote. All right. Onward. We're done now. No,
we did. Got
one minor issue. Okay, item.
You said we're done.
Item four.
We're not.
You can leave.
Thank you, Mayor. At the request of the mayor, this item was continued from a city council meeting, a regular city council meeting, to this workshop. At that city council meeting, there was a lot of traffic data that was presented to the council. We are not here today to rehash or represent that data. What our presentation will consist of generally is a financial analysis of the program. And there will be some slides in regard to collision analysis and violation analysis. Those were requested by the mayor. They are in this presentation. There'll be four different speakers today. And also, the financial information that we're presenting is our best estimate as to what we believe we will take in or not take in as a result of this program. So having said that, I will have Debbie Foster go ahead and start.
Hey, good afternoon. Good afternoon. Go ahead, move forward. What we've done, as the city manager said, is that we this slide, just we're going to review the collection process just to kind of let you inform you of the slight differences between a moving violation and administrative citation, and then we're going to move on to some of the assumptions, and then I'll go ahead and roll that into basically the revenue and the cost estimates and the bottom line. So the review of the collection process, starting on the left side with a moving violation, obviously the whole red flex process would remain the same, but as far as a police officer reviewing the photos produced for the violation, then that information is through the red flex software. Red flex, once it's determined that that violation would move forward, red flex would mail the violation to the individual and then also to the county traffic court. Then the county actually reports the violation to the DMV, and the individual remits to the county, and then the county remits to the city. A little bit difference in the administrative citation process, in that the first process is the same. What would be envisioned as far as a change in this is red flex would forward the information to a third-party collector, and that third-party collector would be handling the administrative citation portion and would mail the citations to an individual. Then the non-payment on any type of non-payment that the collector is unable to collect from their perspective, that actually can be reported to the Franchise Tax Board. So on the left side, where the information is reported to the DMV, non-payment can actually be forwarded to the Franchise Tax Board. That's an interagency offset program that's available to cities. And what happens there is that if an individual, they would match up, our third-party collector would match up Social Security numbers. We use this process on our current administrative citations. They have a process where they match up Social Security numbers if that's available. They have a whole variety of databases that are available to them. And then that information is forwarded on to the Franchise Tax Board. If an individual has lottery winnings, they have an income tax return, or any type of other way that maybe the state has collected some kind of garnishments, then if they owe anything to a city, let's say in this case, then that money would come out before they actually forward in. So that's a little bit different mechanism that is available in the administrative citation process. Then the individual, in the case that they are paying, they remit to the third party collector. Actually, everything's payable to the city of Corona. They deposit it into our bank account. The vendor remits it to the city. So that's as far as the collection process. Okay, a little bit of the revenue and expense assumptions, and then I'll go ahead after this and actually show you how that kind of plays out. We used, just as in our analysis, a sixteen thousand citations per year, and that's based on the 5 months we've had. We just 5 months and straight lined it over a 12-month period. And so we're using there. And then the Red Flex annual agreement is $350,000, and that would be in both different scenarios. So on the left side, in the moving violation side, the component that actually comes to the city is $132 per citation. We have approximately a 60% recovery rate, and this is based on historical traffic violations that we already have or other violations that we've written over the number of years. So that's the recovery rate. And then also in this instance, we would have staff time for the police, them reviewing the photographs that Red Flex would do, so you still have that staff time involved. Then on the right side, in comparison, administrative citation would be $100 per citation. Now we're estimating, and there again, as Brad had said earlier, we're doing these estimates based on the information that we have that's available that we could compare, try to look at similar types of processes. We have approximately about a 50% recovery rate on our administrative citations, and that is historical information currently on all other administrative citations. It's about a 38% recovery rate before it actually goes to the state, about 12% that we get through that intercept program for the Franchise Tax Board. That rate could vary, but in our analysis, we're using a 50% because that's an average collection that we have on administrative citations. And then on the right side, we also have that same staff time for police. That would actually be the same, but there would be more time involved in the administrative citation process because the finance department would be involved in that process. So you'll see that in a minute. And then on the third-party collector, there's a charge of $5 per citation that we forward over to the third-party collector. And then there's also a 15% of collections that would be a portion of their fee. Also, any of the citations that are forwarded onto the Franchise Tax Board, there's a $5 charge per citation, or that's roughly a citation. And this is based on other agreements that we have with a third-party collector, be it $5 per citation. So with that, that's also what we did is we're going to be using the historically what we've administrative citations that have actually moved forward. Now, and then the appeal process for administrative citation, and this would be an estimate, it would be what we've used in our numbers is $85 per hour, and we've used very, very minimum, just 2 hours per week, 52 weeks per the year. So we used it a very, very minimum on the appeal process if we were to look at this. Go ahead and move forward. What we did here is basically all the assumptions that we had to date, put those in, moving violations on the left side, administrative citations on the right. We've used, in this analysis, remember, it was 16,000 citations. And then we've incorporated in the recovery rate, so that would be the gross revenue. And then the staff time, if you notice, as I had mentioned before, the staff time changes a little bit on the right side because that includes the finance department staff time in administering the administrative citation process. Red Flex agreement would remain the same, and then the third-party collector, we would have additional costs for that. Now, you might think, why doesn't the finance staff just do that? We've actually been very successful in using a third-party collector for our administrative citations. As I mentioned, we have about a 50% recovery rate, and the net actually with the net of expenses is about a 34% recovery rate when you factor that all in. Before we used a third-party collector, we only had about a 10-15% recovery rate. Now, that seems really low, but you have to keep in mind that the incentive for someone to pay, give you just kind of an example, our collection rate on utility bills is 99%. Our collection rate on business license going to small claims court is at 98%. So we do have some high recovery rates in other areas that we have in the city. Property tax is around 94%. But then DUIs on a collision that's happened and an individual receives a DUI, we only have about a 24% collection rate. So our collection rates vary depending on the type of activity that it be. DUI, often they're incarcerated after that, and so we have a very low collection rate. Our collection rate. So that 50%, as I mentioned, was because of that's really the average citation that could go higher, lower. I'd imagine it could even possibly be lower. There's not necessarily, there's not as much incentive necessarily to pay if it's on a DMV record. But this is the best estimate that we have based, and we just use that based on our administrative citations. Now, the next slide we have is we just wanted to do, we have this slide and then another slide. All we did here was just said, instead of the 16,000 in volume, let's just reduce that by 10%. Then we've recalculated the numbers because some of those are flat rate fees and some of them were based on the number of citations. So this slide is just saying, what if we had 10% less in volume? What would that revenue and expenditure look like? In the next slide, this would be if, let's say, we had, maybe a several years down the road, or if it was a 25% reduction in volume, we just wanted to look at the revenue and cost, the different scenarios. So if it was a 25% reduction in volume from what we're actually seeing at this point, the 5 months that we've been in the program, then that would be the revenue and the cost in the different assumptions and the different types of processes.
Hold on. Any questions for Debbie? Debbie, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Before we move on. It's going to be more efficient if we just go ahead and finish your segment instead of going back.
Sure.
The 50% is based on what kind of admin sites, and without the FTB process, correct? Without that incentive?
That actually uses the FTB process, and that is for planning, building, animal control, different the other administrative citations. We've had that administrative citation process for 8 or 9 years, and that's based on the collections that we have. Your animal control citations are less than 50. Your building and planning code enforcements are a little bit higher, but you have to, as I mentioned before, you kind of have to look at somewhat the incentive. If someone has a administrative citation on a building and the business is going to be closed down because they're out of compliance, then there's a lot more incentive to pay. So that 50% is the average. We take the total revenue based on all the administrative citations that were written, and then what we've actually recouped, and that's where we got the 50%. So 38% from the third-party collector, and the third-party collector forwards it onto the franchise tax board, and then 12% more we get back.
And you're using that process now, a third-party collector and
correct.
A franchise tax board?
Correct.
On all citations?
Any ones that haven't been paid, so it's about 62% of that haven't been paid to the third-party collector. The third-party collector, this is in their fees. They actually handle that whole process. They electronically forward it onto the franchise tax board. So they handle that whole process. When the money is received, it's deposited in our bank.
Okay. Karen?
Deb, there's a couple things. So in the staff time, is that including, like, if there's an appeal or somebody wants to challenge the citation, is that included in that staff time?
That's what we did as far as in the staff time for the police department staff time. We looked at how much time that, like for the police department, we looked at how much time they spend in appeals for red light violations now, and we actually factored it down to, you know, the estimates. Whether we worked with the police department to know how much time they had, and then we factored that in. So that would incorporate that based on, obviously, the assumptions on other red light appeals. So that would be staff time on that.
Okay, that's just staff time, but what about somebody who oversees that? I mean, you're not going to put...
That's in the collector's process.
Oh, okay.
So back on slide three. Yeah. So back there at the bottom where it has appeal process, that's all under the third-party collector. So you'd pay the citation, the percentage, their process, if whatever ones they forward onto the franchise tax board, and then you pay for the appeal. It's 85. We estimate 80, and this would be at the low end, $85 an hour.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. At the previous council discussion on this matter, a question was raised regarding extending the clearance times in order to avoid the need for the enforcement such as we have. To answer that question, first let me state that the Public Works right now in maintaining the signals, we time the clearance times according to state and federal standards. That is according to the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and the key word in that standard is uniform. We look at consistency between all of the signals within Corona, but also as we go outside this jurisdiction, it's very important that the jurisdictions maintain this consistency as to and not provide surprise to the driver as they end up in a different intersection with a different clearance time or different types of clearance times in other jurisdictions. In Corona, we meet or exceed all of the minimum standards. And if we were to extend yellow times, right now what we would expect to happen if we extended that clearance time is there might be a short-term drop or a short-term reduction in the number of red light violations for that particular move. Unfortunately, driver behavior is such that they will eventually adjust to that clearance time, and the violations for the red light would ultimately probably rise back up to the same level over a period of time, which we really don't necessarily have an idea how long that time is. And again, that would provide inconsistency at that particular intersection for that particular move. The drivers become used to a longer clearance time that they're not going to have at another location. We can also extend red times. The City of Corona right now applies a 1 second all red phase to each intersection within the city. As the yellow light closes and the red light comes on, it is red in each direction for 1 second to make sure the intersection is clear to provide safety for all traffic movements. The standard allows for up to 2 seconds, depending on the geometrics of the intersection and such. If those times are expended or extended, there would not be an expected impact in terms of the violations, because once the red light comes on, that is when the violation is issued. So no matter how long the red is on, those violations still occurred. And it may or may not reduce accidents. The clearance time is very important. As you see, we apply a 1 second clearance time, but as we extend that clearance time, there is potential for other drivers to start to enter the intersection wondering why it is all clear and why no movements are taking place. So that can also end up being a hazard to us as those drivers do that. One other slight piece of information that has to figure into this is every second that we use in extending these clearance times or red times also comes out of the green times. So there are capacity issues ultimately related to any adjustments we make on the yellow and or red times. Any questions?
Yeah, Kip, I got a couple for you. You said that adding a second for an all red clearance interval could be dangerous?
Not necessarily a second. We apply a second right now across all the
intersections. You're saying adding another second would be dangerous?
Adding more time could potentially be dangerous. I'm not sure where that time break would happen, but what happens with driver behavior, if they see the intersection is unused, no movements going in, ultimately someone will enter that intersection.
Wait, 2 seconds, not 10 seconds. 1,001, 1,002. You think someone's going to get impatient in 2 seconds?
Not necessarily. The 2 seconds is according to standard. We can go up to 2 seconds and still be within compliance.
Let me just read something to you real quick. From the National Motor Association. It said a yellow light allows drivers who cannot safely stop to pass through the intersection before a light turns red. Occasionally, even safe and attentive drivers may misjudge the time it takes to make it completely through an intersection. Adding an all red clearance interval after the yellow light phase reduces unnecessary accidents. AAA of Michigan and the City of Detroit partnered to make intersections safer, and they found all red clearance intervals to be effective. So I don't mean to put you on the spot, but 2 seconds, if we're trying to be, if the goal when this program came was safety, okay, which I've started to question, but if the goal of the program is safety, to make our intersections safer, how could an additional second, I'm saying, make it more dangerous?
That additional second is allowable within the criteria, within the standard, and I'm not necessarily suggesting that would make it dangerous.
I'm a little concerned about the where these presumptions come that a second is going to make people antsy and want to jump through a red intersection and jump the green light.
It's more likely that several seconds would cause that sort
Thank
of.
Thank you. Okay. And I'd hope we'd consider these. I'll add one other thing on the longer yellow requirements. Recently, Texas legislature ended the red light camera program in the state of Texas. But one of the things that came out of it was they put a couple of enhanced, and they felt the Senate might not pass what the legislature had passed. And they'd thrown in the bill, I'll just quote from the Ortiz-Elkins Amendment. Already the states of Ohio and Georgia have enacted longer yellow requirements to great effect. In Georgia, 7 cities known to have lengthened yellow since January have seen violations decrease by 70% to 80%. A Texas Transportation Institute study documented a 40% decrease in collisions after testing the benefits increasing the yellow warning given to motorists before an intersection signal changes from green to red. So before we make some assumptions, I hope we really do some good research, because I think these are good things, with or without the red light cameras. If we can do these things to make these intersections safer, we need to look at it. So I just want to counterpunch there, Kip. So any other questions for Kip?
I'll just mention, I'll let you know tomorrow, because I'll be in Texas tomorrow, but the Texas is also one of the few places, well, probably some places in the South, where they may not have the red light cameras, but they will escort you to the courthouse, too. So I don't think we want that.
God bless Texas. Spiegel, Karen.
My question, Kip, is when Steve brings up another state, are there different rules per state, so that when you said that the standard, is that a standard of California that allows for the 2 seconds, or is that a standard nationwide?
It's a California standard, but it is also a nationwide standard. And for the most part, these clearance times are very much consistent throughout those standards.
So when he was saying that Texas allows more, then it's not much more. It's that extra second then.
I'm not sure exactly in the cases. The mayor, I believe, was referring to yellow times at that point. The yellow time standards are based on a number of issues, and including the width of the intersection, the speed of the traffic prevailing as they approach. And so I'm not sure where they're making their adjustment in that particular case.
Okay, thank you.
We could contact them and find out, I'm sure. Okay, Stanley.
Mr. Field, when Mr. Nolan asked you about the length of the red light being extended and whether or not that might become a dangerous scenario, what you had outlined, if I understood you correctly, what you had outlined was basically the flip side of the expectations of a driver at or approaching an intersection, much like they would if they were approaching a yellow light. Is that what I should have understood, or that in the case of a yellow light, they have certain expectations for how long a yellow light might last? Likewise, they would have similar expectations for how long a red light might last before they would begin to enter the intersection.
That is true. There is an expectation that some traffic will be moving in an intersection at any given time.
Okay.
So an all red phase, while we find it to be very effective, there is some limit to where that will be effective before somebody enters the intersection.
Okay, and again, your description of that wasn't necessarily an opinion, but rather a reflection of what is communicated through the manual uniform traffic control devices.
Yes, and other empirical studies, yes.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Next.
We were asked to provide collision information on red light camera locations and list the primary collision factors for each location. We decided to look at these specific locations at two separate time periods. The two time periods that we're going to use for comparison are January 1st, 2008 through August 1st of 2009 and July 1st, 2006 through December 31st of 2007. This first slide, January 2008 through August 2009, shows 51 accidents occurred during this time frame. The slide also lists the primary collision factors by category. If you look at the left upper part of the slide, it says PCF, that's the primary collision factor. Those lists of violations are usually ones out of the vehicle code. On the very bottom, it says other. Those violations aren't usually identified by vehicle code section. They usually are things like someone coming into the police department to fill out a self-report on an accident. We don't investigate those. They document the incident, and they don't end up with the primary collision factor. So that's what that represents. Again, that list on the right is the total number of violations that occurred on each category based on the five separate red light camera locations.
Next slide.
This next slide is the time period of July 2006 through December 31st of 2007. This slide shows 69 accidents occurred during this time frame. Slice also shows the list of primary collision factors in by category, just as the previous slide did, also listing the total number by category in the right-hand column for the different violations. A comparison of the two time frames for accidents show accidents have declined over time. It is also interesting to note that accidents have also declined over the same time period at all signalized intersections throughout the city of Corona. We're also asked to provide the number of violations at each of the red light camera locations during the time the program has been in effect. This slide reflects the total detections for the different type of traffic movements. The time period for violations detection analysis is from May 1st, 2009 through September 30th, 2009, which is the 5-month time frame the program has been in effect. The slide outlines the five red light camera approaches for the four intersections. The three different violations that can occur are outlined and include left turns, right turns, and straight through detections. This report is based on the total number of detections prior to screening for citations for each of the five different red light camera approaches. Staff was asked to see if we can obtain the actual violations that were forwarded to the court system. That request has been made with Redflex. Our current contract with Redflex does not include a provision for them to provide analytical statistical data. The report that Redflex will provide us will be based on violations lane by lane. We're not sure what this report will look like, and it may require some more work from us to take a look at and make sure it meets what we need to forward to staff. When that is done, we will forward that report to staff. Based on the data for red light camera violations, it shows that left turn violations were the highest percentages of violations. And as you can see in the right-hand column, the red left turns represented 62.2% of the violations, followed by right turns at 16.8%. And then straight through violations at 15%. That concludes my report, and myself and staff are here to answer any questions.
Any questions? All right, go ahead, Karen.
Chief, the unsafe speed that was on the previous slide, is that accelerating to make it through an intersection, or they were just oblivious? What was the unsafe speed?
Unsafe speed usually is 22.350, the vehicle code, and it could pertain to going too fast. That was the main contributing factor. There could be an associate factor to the accident as well, but that was the main reason. They were going too fast. It caused them to do something in that intersection, and that was listed as the reason for the primary reason for that accident. But there could be other factors as well, but that one would be listed in speed. The actual speed is a factor, and speed could be going too fast, but it also could be going too fast for the conditions. So if the speed should have been zero, it should have been zero. So it just depends on the factor. Primary unsafe speed could be it should have been zero. Someone gridlock in an intersection, you hit somebody, should have not hit that car. You should have stopped. So it doesn't mean you're doing 20 miles over the speed limit. You were maybe doing 10 and you should have been doing zero. So that section does apply to a lot of different situations.
Okay, thank you.
Chief, let's go back. When we implemented the program, it was primarily for safety. We wanted to catch violators running through red lights and primarily make our streets safer, correct?
That's correct.
And that's pretty much the standard. When these things have been implemented around other cities and states, that's the goal, is to make streets safer. But looking at it now, the question came up at the council meeting that if we reduce the money from $132, which we hope we receive down the road from the state, to $100, the program may not function. Okay, and then going back to Debbie, the $100 is also, we didn't take in consideration second-time offenders that go to $200 if we did that. So there's a lot of assumptions here we haven't made that may be way off base. But we made basically $2 million on this in, 5 months? We have potentially $2.1 million coming to us as a city.
Are you talking about raw dollars? Again, we haven't analyzed the dollars we're getting. We're making assumptions, but I'm not really sure the net versus what we get.
Well, $350,000 from $2.1 million, so basically we're somewhere around, we're already in the black, $1.7
million. There's also a percentage that do not get paid, so I'm not really sure what we're going to actually get.
My question is the selection of these, and I'll make this brief so we can get on to and if anybody here wants to talk about the subject, please fill out a blue card and bring it up, because you're going to be next. 85% of the tickets are for left-hand turns and right-hand violations, but the most hazardous ones are the, I'm assuming, are the drive straight through, the T-boners?
Well, I would say left-hand turn ones would be also as dangerous as straight through because of right-of-way issues, because if you're taking a left-hand turn in front of a motorist coming in the opposite direction, that one's going to hit that one directly head-on or pretty abruptly, and I think that would be a pretty serious accident. So I think those are pretty serious as well.
But aren't the left-hand turns pretty much tailing through a left-hand intersection, going into the crossings or going into a shopping center or turning up Magnolia Rimpaw? You're the last guy. It's rude Don't get me wrong, but you're the last guy. The opposing traffic hasn't hit the accelerator yet.
I think that's part of it, Mayor, but also, you know, and I've seen that as well, especially in the McKinley area, because people trail in on that one. But also the difference between that and like a right turn on red is people realize that they're going to miss that light for that left turn, that they're going to have to wait a while, and then you start seeing people that aren't even close that try to get in and get through, and they're not even a close call, and maybe the light's already changed in the direction. I've seen that too, and that's the ones that are even more dangerous. Ones on right turn on reds are more like we're going to stop and go, and it's kind of a rolling California and those kind of things. But I think the left turn on red can be very dangerous, especially for those kind of violations.
But my point is simply that these turning ones, I got some other articles here, I'm not going to bore you with them, from LA and places where they've eliminated the right-hand turn violations. For the most part, these are low-speed violations. No one's moving it. You know, this is not like someone is going to try to catch that just blow through the red light and T-bone somebody going through the intersection, because only 10% of the crashes in the intersections you've chosen have got any crashes attributed from primary collision factor due to violation of a signal. So we put 85% of our violations are not where the collisions are occurring.
Well, again, the program's only been up for 5 months, and I understand we're dealing with a handful of violations over that period of time. Again, I think time will tell what that really looks like over the period of time they normally want you to look at a program such as this is usually 18 months to 2 years to see how that really impacts it. But also part of the criteria is you're trying to reduce the violations that don't result in accidents. And we know that by the volume we're getting that that's still occurring. So I think those that lead to accidents and speeds on roadways and all the other criteria that's involved in selecting an intersection are important as well, because they lead to the same kind of problems.
And again, this is about my whole goal here is the financial impact on these newfound citations, how they're effectively hurting our community and people in the community, whether they're wrong, okay? A lot of them could be very minor violations, but the impact of a $465 ticket or $445, $446, whatever it is, versus $100. And that's my point. So by looking at this, I think it's pretty safe to say revenue could have been part of the motivation for picking some of these locations. This is a money-making deal. This is $2.1 million in 5 months.
Well, at the police department side of it, we were looking at it as a safety issue, and if you look at the fact just of the 5 months we've had the program, the volume seems to be going down. That means money goes down. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea. If the program is successful, then hopefully at some point you can remove that camera and put it in a place that may need it, because driving behavior, I think, does change. And I know it's still very early on, which is 5 months of operation, but we have noticed the volume has gone down over the 5 months of the program, and that's a good thing.
Sure.
I mean, it's less money also, but our goal is for the safety of those intersections, and if it's less money, so be it. The idea is to change the behavior of people not driving correctly. So if that's the case, at some point we would maybe have to remove one and put it in another place that may need it more.
Thank you. Stan.
Chief Midori, at each of these five intersections, all things being equal, had there not been red light violation cameras in place, but there were police officers in those intersections, and those police officers had seen the violations occur, and the police officers had the opportunity and the ability to safely get to the violator, not knowing if there was another additional aspect to that violation taking place or simply somebody failing to stop at the red light, but they could do that. The information that had been reported to us previously and that we discussed at length, I think at the last council meeting, my understanding is the officers would have contacted the violator to determine, at the very least, the reason why the red light was run. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And at that time, based on the information that was shared by you in our last council meeting, there was a percentage of those cases in which an officer would have issued a citation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And actually, we learned that for all the other violations that go on in the city, the officers are probably more likely to issue a citation when they see a violation of any kind at that time. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And there is no inconsistency between issuing a citation for a red light violation versus a speeding violation, as I think the example was cited earlier, or a turning violation, or some of the others that were listed in the analyses that you provided today. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Okay, before we get into an open discussion amongst us, well, let's go ahead and hear our blue cards. And again, if you want to speak on the subject, and I'm really interested in the financial impact. That's what's going to come down to in our discussion after this we hear from you. So let's start with Mark Einan. I know I butchered that, sorry.
Mr. Mayor, City Council, people, how are you? I was here on our last discussion that we had. I've been sick in bed for like 3 days, haven't got out, but I thought it was important enough to get here today to talk about this. I'll keep my distance from you, sorry. But my neighbor across the street, after we talked on our last discussion, who actually is very politically active and has worked on a number of your campaigns, I said, you know, it just seemed like that the people and the city council people really weren't listening. I mean, they had their minds made up already, preconceived. And I hope that's not the case. I hope you'll listen to what we have to say before, you know, you make final judgments on things. As far as, you know, the data that you brought forth with, you know, 5 months this year versus 5 months last year, you know, what is it, like 18 less infractions, accidents or something over the what you're showing us on the screen? Is that how I read that right?
I'm sorry. Repeat your comparison.
You're showing us the five-month period at these intersections that there was like 18 less accidents this year or in the five-month period than there was the last year in those previous 5 months?
I don't remember the exact. There has been a decrease over the 5 months.
I would suggest that, you know, maybe that we ought to consider that's the possible, you know, the possible reason for that might be a lot less people driving this year than there was last year because of the economy, that type of thing. Because the reason why is, you know, I went home and I did some research online, and I'm sure that, you know, most of you before you ever made your decision did the same thing to put these lights in. So many of the independent studies have shown that these red light cameras actually create more accidents than they prevent. There are a couple other studies that prove the opposite, but they I'd like to read something on one of those that those later. But like the city of San Diego, for instance, they found out that there was a 25% increase in accidents at the lights that at the camera light intersections than there were at any other intersections in the whole city. And they said there's many more rear-end accidents with people making panic stops. And there was study after study after study with universities and Atlantic Journal Constitution and many other studies that all come out with that same conclusion that, you know, this this causes more accidents than it prevents. If I can just read something real quick. I thought this was interesting. This is from the House Majority Leader, Dick Armey. His staff put this together. Of course, he's not they're not the majority anymore, but anyway. You know, he said, well, first of all, you know, the thing is, do we have to ask ourselves, are we really doing this for safety, or are we doing this for revenues? And, you know, most people believe it's revenues more than safety, I'm sad to say. But, you know, you said if we really, in their study, Dick Armey's group did a study, and they said that the biggest preventers, like I say, is extending the yellow lights and maybe putting an extra second or two on the four-way stop, red light stop. That's what the study found would actually, and they have done that in other cities, and that has really slowed down the accident rate of these different cities. But I but to go back to the study, I don't know if you're getting your information that the cities use, because most of the cities use this from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. This is one of the biggest ones that support, you know, these red light cameras. And it's kind of interesting because the man that is over that over the Insurance Institute, before he was in there, he was actually the top transportation official for New York City at the time that the city began looking into becoming the first jurisdiction in the country to install red light cameras. In other words, he's the father of the red light cameras and in America. And, you know, there's other conflicts of interest, like the Institute of Transportation Engineers is another one that came out with the studies, and it's another one that's highly used. But they are actively involved in lobbying for and even drafting legislation to implement red light cameras. They are closely tied to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which in turn is funded by the companies that stand to profit handsomely any time points are assessed to a driver's license. I think we really have to think about where, you know, where our information comes from and look into the depth of this. I would really hope that, you know, what we're doing is not just supposedly for safety issues. I got to say, I hope it's just not for revenue issues that we're doing, because basically city after city has been using this program for revenues. And it's just sad in a time like this that we would go to that. I would hate to think that's the case, because I would rather see, you know, a tax increase. And even though I hate tax increases, if we can't keep our spending under control, that I'd rather see a slight tax increase of $30 a citizen versus a $450 ticket. And then, you know, who knows, a couple thousand dollars on top if our insurance rates goes up over the next couple of years. You know, I'd rather pay that a little less and just a little tax rate than what you're trying to get financially out of us citizens.
Okay, we can finish up, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that was the same study where they actually called it red lights a tax levied on the people. Next is Don Brown.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. If I can get your name and address also, and try to keep it to three, or we're a little looser at these things, but try to keep it 3 or 4 minutes. Go ahead, Dawn.
Okay, I got a ticket for stopping at the, going through the red light. I couldn't see the red light technically because there was a big truck in front of me. The camera that the film shows zooming through in the intersection at Primpom and Magnolia, you cannot zoom through. But what I mainly came for is that I've got a number of people that would like have signed up on my little tiny petition to, you know, about the red light. I'd like to give that to you. And then I have a letter of a lady who was driving through it, and the light was green, and she got the camera also. And then on the 24th, just for the heck of it, I went over there, and like the gentleman was talking, he was saying that it's standard length of lights. Well, at 11:09, the light was 3.71 seconds for yellow. Then at 11:10, it's 4.13 seconds. On 11:12, it was 3.40 seconds. So it was fluctuating. So that doesn't tell me that, you know, his section is wrong on, because nobody can judge what length of time it will be. So, right. Anyway, I mainly came because I was going to tell you that $456 ticket I'm getting is going to kill me. My husband's on Social Security. I have a part-time job. Excuse me. We're on the verge of losing our house. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Take your time.
Thank you.
Don, I have a question for you, if
yes.
You can. I met you in your office, in my office.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't mind, your monthly, and that's just to make a point, you're on a fixed income.
Yes.
And do you mind saying what the monthly income with your
husband? My husband brings in $799 a month from Social Security, and mine's about $400.
Your part-time job.
Yeah, it's a part-time job. I cannot find, because of my age, nobody wants to hire me, and the company that I work for has only put me on part-time.
Okay, Ed, I want to talk about the impact on you at the light, because I looked at the violation. It was difficult to be put into your perspective from the camera.
I noticed that when I looked on the internet with the camera, whatever it is that they do, they have the cars going really fast. If you notice that truck that was in front of me, he stopped for a split second. And he stalled out. I'm sorry. He stalled out, and I thought it was far enough into the traffic line that I had to get out of the road for the oncoming cross traffic.
Okay. And do you plead guilt or plead innocent?
I can't plead guilty, or I haven't sent it in, because I can't afford the $456 to fight the ticket, to pay the bail to fight the ticket.
What do you mean?
Well, you have to post the bond before you can fight the ticket.
Okay, Chief, is that to plead innocent? To plead innocent to go to court, you have to pay the full money up front?
I believe if you decide to contest the ticket, you do have to post the bail amount, because then you subsequently have another date to go to court to have the matter heard. So I believe you do have to do that. But I also understand that the court understands people that are having financial problems, and sometimes are willing to work those things out. They do have a financial unit. I don't know how they deal with those issues, but I did speak to a commissioner that said that he refers a lot to that unit, so they're willing to work with people. I think that she needs to inquire.
You know, if I go over there and I talk to him, I can't afford, $25, $30?
Chief, what the question is, my question is, if someone wants to plead innocent, but they can't pay the bail up front, will the staff at the court, will they make arrangements for that? Will they make an exception?
I'm being told by staff that they would be able to make financial arrangements to let that happen.
Okay.
So they got to acquire, according to my staff, that they will make arrangements for those people experiencing hardships, financial hardships, to contest their tickets without posting the entire amount. So she's going to need to check with court staff. There is a number she can talk to my staff that are here to talk about how that works, and maybe that might help her.
Okay. Yeah, if you can have John help her with that, because I get a lot of people, that's a problem. They can't go up front with the money. Okay, Don, thank you. Okay, next I have, let's do Eileen Conrad. Name and address for our record, please. Eileen?
Good afternoon, Mayor and council members. I'm the proud recipient of one of the red light tickets. I understand the need for safety, and I also understand the need for revenue. It goes hand in hand. I mean, you know, there's less taxes coming in because home values are down. I've been in the industry for many, many years, so I understand what drives all that. In my particular situation, what happened was the amber light at the Crossings intersection. I was making a left-hand turn into the Crossings to get my computer fixed at Best Buy because I happened to be unemployed. And as I entered the intersection, it went from green to amber quickly. The amber clearance rate is at 3.25 seconds, which to me doesn't allow for much reaction time, especially if anything is going on in front of you. What happened was the cars that were preceding me in the intersection, one of them had stopped, which caused me to be in the middle of the intersection and get the ticket. So what I would recommend is that possibly if you can make consistency throughout your amber lights within Corona, what I'm seeing is the surrounding lights within that area, and it's made me also more cognitive of what's going on when I'm in the city. I'm finding myself counting the seconds with the amber lights. Most amber lights are anywhere from 4 to 6 seconds, and anything that's like 4 to 5 seconds allows you a lot more reaction time to get through that intersection. However, if somebody is stopped in front of you, it's going to create a problem to where you're going to get the ticket, you can't get through that intersection, and possibly you might even rear end that person if you're not alert enough. I was at that point. That zone was a 45 mile an hour zone, and I happened to be proceeding through the intersection at 20 miles an hour. I spoke to another lady today, and she's in Riverside, also on a fixed income. Her experience was that somebody honked at her behind her while she was making a turn, and in her picture you could see her, you know, in shock that this person was actually forcing her through the intersection. Had she not moved, she would have been rear-ended. So my recommendation is just the appropriate clearance times and a reduction in the fee. $456 is way too much. I think a fee of somewhere around the $200 level would be more appropriate for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Jose.
I just want to address a couple of things. Gentleman before us didn't mind paying a little bit more taxes. Historically, when tax gets to 50% of a person's income, every great nation has gone down. And I believe New York's already had 50%. We pay too damn much taxes as it is. We don't need any more taxes. And the other issue about less driving, I'm very, very familiar with Tyler Otto. His business has dropped considerably down, not because people are driving slower or because there's less citations being issued, but because there's less people on the road. Consequently, there's less wrecks and whatever. Now, his business is way, way down. Now, as far as the intersection that I'm most familiar with on Rempar, that has been a nightmare ever since I can remember. Before they did the construction that just was just finally finished, you come up to the first light, and then you only got a couple hundred feet before the next light, and then you had another light just on the other side of the freeway. The light on the freeway would be green or be red, and the other two lights would be green. So the traffic backs all the way up. Then the stupid light in front gets red, it goes green as you're turning red over here. Now, they've done a lot of improvements, but you still have the problem in that You got a major center, big shopping center to the south. Well, it's all around the circle. And then to make matters worse, on the easterly side of the freeway, you got American asphalt, they got trucks coming out of there all the time, big trucks. So you have an awful lot of big trucks. And in the evening or in the morning or if the freeway's tied up a little bit, you'll get the big semis as they're trying to make a turn. If you're going north or south on Magnolia and you're trying to make a left-hand turn, you get caught behind a vehicle where you're partway into the light, and then you're stuck. The other problem that you run is that you have an awful lot of people, kids, bicycles, and whatever you not. Traffic, and they just don't follow the.
Okay, Jose, if I can help you, did you get a citation?
No, I haven't got a citation. No.
Okay.
But I've talked to a lot of people, and my next door neighbor. She had to take off of work to go take care of a citation, and the judge wanted to hear nothing about it. You can't contest it. Pay the stupid fine. She says, I don't have the money to pay the fine. They didn't make arrangements for her to make payments. But as far as, if you want to contest, you got to come up with money up front. I talked to another individual that lives on France, just around the corner from me. And she got a ticket, and she's making payments on it. And at the time, she was unemployed. She finally got to work right now. But we're talking about $460 down there. And one of the things that I'm finding out is that the vast majority of people trying to get work right now, they're getting work like 4 to 5 hours a day, 4 to 5 days a week, 25, 30 hours a week. It's I find a lot of people that cannot get a full-time job, and that's at $8 to $9 an hour. And remember that a ticket works against you several ways. Number one, you pay taxes on that money. So it's not that you can take that right off your top. You can't deduct it off your taxes. So that's a tremendous hardship. And as the other gentleman said, I believe it's nothing more than just a way to raise money. Because if safety was the real concern, how can a stupid light take into consideration, like you have then you got the stupid high school down the road. And then on the next block, you got the elementary school. And then you got another school down Fullerton. You got all this traffic coming out there. And under normal circumstances, I see no problem with the light there. But when you have traffic coming down and somebody stalls, you have a big truck trying to make a turn, it would be so helpful to have a policeman there that if a truck gets stalled or something, or a car's in his way, to stop the traffic and get him going, as opposed to having a light there just flashing at you. I think that light is just, it might serve its purpose somewhere else, but that traffic is way too heavy. You got too many different contingencies are taken care of you, to take into consideration.
Do we need to finish up?
High school.
Need to finish up, Jose.
Hey, pardon?
Need to hurry up a little bit.
Okay. Anyway, the last thing I really want to bring is, why should the state get part of this money? I don't understand. I mean, it's bad enough that you got to pay a $100 fine. $200 I think is outrageous. $100 I think is outrageous. But why should the state pick our pockets more? I don't see what we get out of that additional money.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's because they can't balance a budget and they have no money. Okay. We have no more speakers. Anybody lined up to make comments?
I can go if you want. I have a question for Chief or Captain Cota. On the signals, I thought that the tickets were only issued if someone crossed the limit line when it was already red.
You want to speak to that? Captain Cota will speak to that.
Okay.
Yeah, you are correct. The system is designed that there are sensors that are placed in the street pavement itself, and those sensors are situated behind what is known as the limit line. And in basic terms, it's the crosswalk line. And so if somebody actually receives a citation, what that equates to is that their vehicle entered the intersection behind that limit line when the signal turned red, and two, that their vehicle was traveling at least 15 miles per hour.
Because I've had other people who've mentioned, I think like at least one of the speakers, where they were caught in the intersection when it turned red. And if that in fact happens, they can call the traffic department and verify that. I mean, obviously, you have the internet part you can look at, but I did talk to someone who didn't have an internet connection, and I said, "Well, call traffic, and isn't that one of the things that you will do?"
Sure. If we have a person that's received one of the notices, and they don't agree that they violated the red light, they're welcome to come to the police department. We will sit down with them to view that video, and if for some reason there was some malfunction, we will take care of that situation.
And they can do that prior to posting bond or doing anything, right?
Yeah, they can do that because they're given a specific amount of time to post that bond or to appear in court. And if, in fact, we need to correct that, we have ample time to do that.
And then what percentage of tickets are we currently going from violation to actual citation?
You know, that varies right now. I can tell you for the month of September, through all the red light camera locations, 2,023 detections. Out of those, only 1,059 actually received notices. That equates to about 52.3%.
Okay. So, you know, it's obviously an officer that's reviewing that video and actually making that determination whether it is, in fact, a valid citation or not, too. I mean, it's not just a computer doing this.
No, it's just not a computer-generated process. You know, we have an officer that reviews each and every one of those violations and makes a determination of whether or not that violation is something that is deserving of a notice.
And I don't really want to be disrespectful, but what does yellow normally mean at an intersection when the light turns yellow?
Well, that's one thing that you know, we try very hard to educate our community and public about, is that often people see the yellow light as a call to hurry up and get through the intersection. Really, the yellow light is there to warn you that that signal is changing and is encouraging you to slow down and stop.
Because I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions is people, oh, the yellow, I better speed up quick so I can get through the intersection. And really, you know, if you're watching in advance, you know approximately how long the light should be either green or yellow and take appropriate action. I mean, it's not that these things were invented yesterday. And lastly, on this, one thing I want to bring up, and I don't disagree that $400-some-odd is a lot of money, but the other misconception is there's a $20-25 fine for being on your cell phone, and what does the ticket end up being for that $20-25? Isn't it? It's over $200, $250, something like that.
Yeah, I believe it's somewhere in the area of $126, and a lot of that is court assessment fees that
right.
get put on those.
Which
those,
is a big part of what this
fines.
Is too.
Yes.
Okay, because I think that's one of the things too. I know. I actually was one of the ones that went to Sergeant Marshall a long time ago talking about red light violations and how we can actually curb some of these, because we've actually had deaths and accidents in Corona with red light violations. And, you know, he came back with some of the other information that we've already seen before, is that it's almost impossible without a huge team of officers to really cite people. And that was one of the reasons to do this. And now, you know, what is, how many months are we into this not being on your cell phone and driving, and it seems like that's gone back to being as bad or worse than it ever was before. I mean, I was nearly hit on the way over here, not running through a red, but going a truck that was turning, and the guy was going like this and doing this, and he was on his cell phone, and he was in a rather large truck, and it's gotten to the point where it's just ridiculous. So stay off your cell phone if you're driving.
Stan?
Mrs. Foster, at the beginning of the afternoon, you laid out some figures and talked about the portion of, I'll just say generically, a $456 fine for such a violation, red light camera violation. How much of that money, once more, how much of that money actually is directed toward the city of Corona?
On the red light violation, it would be $132.
Okay. And you being the math expert, not me, from 456, roughly a third
right.
of that total figure is that amount of the fine that is actually the fine itself going to the city of Corona.
That'd be correct.
The remainder of that is the court costs, the court fees, the court assessments, and things like that, that the court has imposed over time through a variety of other legislative acts and local ordinances at the county level, perhaps, to mitigate their expenses so they can continue on with their court programming, things like that, I assume. Is that correct? Plus a number of other programs throughout the state.
I'm going to let the chief answer that. I'm not familiar with that.
That's correct. Obviously, that there's a lot involved in
yeah.
the process, and there's a lot of people that are involved in that, and some of those costs are paid for through that.
Correct. Okay. I just wanted to stress that the enforcement piece here, when it gets to the fine itself, the fine is exactly the same as other violations. Regardless of the total amount, that percentile the city of Corona only gets so much of that. The remainder of it, the balance of it, is retained by the courts and redistributed elsewhere for other things that have, in many cases, very little to do with the city of Corona.
That's correct. Each citation at different values still have a percentage of those citations going to pay for those costs.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We'll follow up on that, Chief. So basically, in the last 5 months the program started, we are going to see $2.1 million. We made the state an additional newfound $6 million. Maybe
I'd have to have the percentage we get and all those things. I'm not sure. We haven't really gotten to the point to see how that equates to money being made, but I think that's still yet to be seen.
Well, this is anyway. My point is this, and it's not my point. I believe in the program from the start because it would make our streets safer. My problem is I didn't ask some of the questions at the time. Where are they going to go? You know, 85% of these are, you know, low-speed violations. Again, and I'll make a point about the yellow, if everybody starts slowing on a yellow, the reality is we all drive here, everybody in this room, if that thing turns yellow and we start hitting brakes, as they found across the country, without going into studies, people start crashing more. And that's why they've increased crashes at intersections with cameras, because people stop on the yellow. You're right. It's meant to slow down, Captain, but the reality is everybody mentally goes, I got that. And after 3 or 4 seconds, you know, I'm not going to make it. We stop. That is reality in California driving for you and for I and everybody else who drives. I want to read something because my point on this is simple. I want to beleaguer this. I hope the council will look at this as, at least we now know, civil violations or administrative citations work. The city won't make as much money, but we'll be possibly saving a lot more money from our community that can be spent in our economy and not hurt people on these fixed incomes, whether they made a mistake or not. I know there's people out there say, double the fine. Make it $1,000. By God, we'll teach them. Anyway, this I just want to read this very quickly. Newman. No one knows where Newman, California is, but I'd like to go there. Some traffic violators will have their infractions handled in-house by the Newman Police Department instead of handed over to the court system beginning October 8, 2009. Council members last week approved, those offenders should still bring their checkbook, though, as the city's new administrative citation alternative to a standard traffic ticket carries a local fine. Council members last week approved a fine schedule for traffic-related offenses in which administrative citations are issued. In most cases, first-time offenders will pay $150. With fines climbing to $500 for third offense within a 12-month period. The fines are similar to administrative citation fines imposed for municipal code violations such as animal control issues and failure to have a business license. For the first time, though, the city will have the authority to issue the local citations to traffic offenders as well as for code violations. Police Chief Adam McGill said the new system potentially benefits motorists because fines are lower than those incurred with a traditional ticket, and the matter doesn't show up on a driver's record, whether you think that's a good thing or not. Convenience is also a benefit. You can contest a citation or pay the fine right here in Newman. The advantage for us is that 100% of the revenue stays right here in the city, as opposed to 30% of a standard ticket or more. Instead of 30%. We also don't have to send an officer to Modesto to testify if someone challenges the tickets. That just happened a couple weeks ago. This stuff is happening. It can happen. It's an alternative to issuing a very painful citation, and in what the gentleman talked about the study earlier about the majority leader calling this a tax, he was right. There's a lot of money behind red flags from insurance companies. When you get a ticket, you get a point, that is expensive. And my kids got tickets recently. My insurance I had to take them off my policies. I mean, it's painful. I look at Karen. Here's another one. I'm just going to throw this out there real fast because we're not going to get this finished in 10 minutes. But Governor Bill Richardson, red light camera fines capped at $100. Richardson says he signed the bill on all communities in New Mexico and are treated fairly, and municipalities aren't hitting drivers with excessive fines. Seattle, the legislature just they pass these things and said you cannot charge more than a traffic ticket. Of course, the most expensive traffic ticket is $250, but Seattle charges $124. Columbus, they're removing them all over the United States. I don't want to indict the program. but it looks like it's about money. And right now, myself, a lot of people in this community are hurting financially. So I hope we are just all doing our research. We look at this. I'd like to bring it back down the road and get this thing changed. How? I'd like to hear back from you individually. But right now, I'm telling you, this is not, the trend is not putting in more of these things. The trend is actually changing them or eliminating them. So we now know we can do an administrative citation. And it does not, now we don't make as much money. But we still, we do cover the cost of the program. And we're not punishing the community. And right now we've already got 7,000 people have got these things. A lot of them are fixed incomes, elderly people, unemployed people. So I think we hopefully will look at this with some compassion. And again, I don't think we're unable to make some changes that's going to benefit the community. So, Karen.
Mayor and Mark, you addressed this, and I have no question that the studies that you're referring to with the insurance companies, and they're very much known to be lobbyists, and there's no question that they may be tainted. But I'm not going to get in a little tit-for-tat match. For every study that you show on that aspect, we can show another one. I've done research on this. The bottom line is, to inform you, Mark, is it's not about whether we're taking the cameras away or not. That's not what today's topic was. Today's topic was on the costs the mayor brought forward that he wanted the ticket price reduced. So it's not the discussion on the cameras. It's on the price. And you referred, Mayor, on a couple occasions of $2.1 million, and that's an inaccurate information that's being passed. I think the information was is that we don't know for sure because you're not including in that the percentage of non-payment, which is actually pretty high. So you're taking the full possible value, which is not something that's going to be received. So I just want the audience to be clear that that's not $2.1 million. And I think we've also had it clarified that the tickets are not given if you're already in the intersection, it turns red. That's the bottom line. If you're already in there, because a couple of you have addressed that you were sitting in the intersection and you couldn't go forward and you got a ticket. Well, if that's true, then you call our Corona PD as it was asked by our chief, and they'll review it with you, and it could be determined. But you've got to do that right away. So before your date has passed, because then it becomes difficult where our officers can't make an adjustment in that. You know, when you talk about the value, and I think Ms. Foster went through several areas of cost factoring it, my concern is if you reduce this, then I will be paying, and you'll be paying, and everybody will be paying for the cost difference of that ticket, because we don't know for sure if the costs are going to cover. So if we reduce it to the $100, as it was clearly pointed out in the previous slides, that it was not totally assured that we will, the first one was what, $2,300 or $23,000 that is a profit?
The net between the revenue and expenditure in the first scenario would be $23,000.
Right. And that would be the highest, that was the book,
That was roughly the highest. That would be, and that would also keep in mind that 50% recovery rate. We don't know what the recovery rate, that's just based on the other administrative citations we have in the program we have.
So you're basically, the potential is we could be, as taxpayers, paying for the cost of those tickets or citations incurred by citizens because we can't charge enough to cover the costs.
If the recovery rate was less than 50%, that could be the situation, or if there was less than the 16,000 administration citations written, then that would go the other way. So if either of those variables changed.
Okay. And as the chief says, we have, what, 18 months to 2 years that we need to really, in order to gain the proper information. I understand, Mayor, that the cost factor, I truly do, on a personal level and from other people who have discussed this with me. And I know that it's viewed, although we know up here that we did not get into this for revenue generating. And I know the appearance to the public is that we did. If we were, we would have had a lot more than four intersections. I mean, that's fact. Riverside is really putting more and more in, and I think that's what's good, what Kip was explaining about, is having some standards so that there's consistency through city to city. But the consistency of doing the reduction into a citation versus going the next city over and paying the full amount. I don't want to be paying, since almost half of our tickets have been given to non-Corona residents, correct? Is it close to half?
Approximately. I think it was 51% Corona residents, something like that.
So now we're even, you take the amount, now we're even, half of that is even dealing with your concern of being a Corona residence. I think I go back to exactly what my intention when we discussed this was for the safety. I truly believe that there is a safety factor. No matter how many studies you want to show, you can say, yes, people slam their brakes on. I also know, in discussing with many people, that if it's a $100 citation, you will have more violators, because I know that it's easier for me to get to that meeting or whatever it is for $100 to pay that fine than to stop at that light and be late. $100 is not a whole lot. To some people, it's a lot. To some people, it's not, because it's not going on your DMV record. There's no teeth and there's no consequence. And so I really feel that if we're talking safety, we're not going to have that same effect when there's not the teeth into the violation. And the bottom line is, this is a violation. You know, if there's a law, if we don't have consequences for breaking that law, then why have the law? And I think that's where my challenge is that, and I can say that, as we know, because I've had those. So, you know, I'm just really torn. And Kip, when Mrs. Conrad had said that there is inconsistency in the she used the word amber lights, how can we address that?
We've addressed that by making double checks in our system. The left turns are all set at 3 seconds consistently across the city, with the exception of these four intersections where the red light cameras are. They are set at 3.1 seconds. That is to make sure that no one gets a violation for under 3 seconds. That is just a simple coverage measure. We have attended some of these intersections at the request of residents within the last few weeks since this issue was brought up, to address these inconsistencies. In each case, we found it to be consistent as we timed it out with them using the proper equipment.
Okay, thank you.
Quick follow-up, Debbie. She just asked you about the, you showed your slides earlier that this potentially, if our retrieval rate on the tickets goes down, we might lose 18,000 or 48,000, something like that. That was based on the 2.1 gross sales.
Now, this, I'll just go over the three.
Let me just ask you a specific question right here, if you don't mind. Okay, this is based on the 5 months, right?
This is based on 16,000 citations, okay. And that would be based on the 5 months that we have.
So if at the end of the year, the 350,000 never changes, that's consistent, right? That's our total output.
For red flags.
For the year.
For red flags.
Right. So if we continue at this pace, we're over $5 million, which would throw this thing kind of in a tizzy.
My
point is, you kept showing a slide after slide that this.
Oh, the $2 million right here, that's not based on the 5 months. That's taking what we have 5 months and then prorating it over and getting the annual figure.
Okay, that is. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so because we had about 6,000 and then we just divided by 5, multiplied by 12, and then that's where we got 16,000 citations. So this would be on an annual basis. The 2.1 million that we show here before the recovery, that would be annualized.
Okay. Mr. Scott.
First off, thank you to the speakers. Really appreciate your comments and your taking your time. And looking at the data that was provided by the police department and addressing the issue of more accidents coming from the cameras, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, the number of accidents has decreased. So that argument, at least up to this point in time, is not valid. Previous information and data that we received indicated that four, if my memory serves me correct, 4 to 7 thousandths of vehicle trips going through the intersections actually were detected, which is a very insignificant number when you're looking at the total number of vehicle trips. So I found that very interesting. Another piece of data that was given today, which is the violation detection analysis sheet, I found it interesting that so many of the violations were for left-hand turns, and especially at Magnolia Rimpaugh and the McKinley Griffin Way intersections, which I tend to frequent most often, both of which on those left-hand turns have given me grief with people plugging up the intersections, making the left-hand turn and thinking, I got that. So if the red light cameras are providing safety, then I am 100% for that. And if they are assisting, which I've heard from folks and I have experienced additional traffic flow, circulation improvement, then that's a side benefit that I am certainly in favor of. It was mentioned that we're not talking today and haven't been talking about the validity of the cameras. We're talking strictly about the citation fee and how much citizens, non-citizens are being charged when they receive their ticket. And if that is in fact the case, as has been stated frequently, then I would request that staff not provide us any additional figures as to accident rates, number of vehicles going through the intersections, because that's not related to the topic. The topic here is the amount that we're going to charge for the ticket and whether it's legally permissible for us to do an administrative citation. It's not how many citations and it's not how many vehicle trips are going through. I just want to be conscious of staff's time that's being allocated to this. I do appreciate the time that you're putting forth, but just ask that we be aware of how much we're asking in a realm that we're not focusing on. Finally, I want to go over to Dean. And Dean, some time ago, we received a legal opinion on the difference between the ticket and the administrative citation and the possibility of us going forth with administration citations and whether that's legal for us to do. So could you give us a recap on that and the legalities of that aspect, since we're talking about, and that is the topic, whether we can legally do that?
Sure. Whether you can adopt an administrative citation is based upon whether you can interpret something to be a municipal code violation, because that's what the city council has the authority to enforce pursuant to administrative citations, any violations of its municipal code. We took a look at the state statute and determined that the vehicle code does allow the city to establish violations of traffic control devices and establish those violations pursuant to either a resolution or an ordinance. We interpret that to mean that the city could adopt a provision that says that it's a violation of your municipal code to violate a traffic control device such as a red light camera. So it would be our opinion that the statute does provide the apparent authority to make a violation of a traffic control device a municipal code violation, thereby having it be an administrative citation. However, the question is whether the state legislature intended for that vehicle code provision to be interpreted that way. There have been other cities that have looked at this issue. The city of Newman is a new one. I think that's relatively recent in the last couple of weeks. I was not aware of that one. Other cities have looked into it, and there's been discussions with the DMV and other state agencies who have indicated that they would potentially challenge the city's ability to do that outside of the normal state citation process. So there is a legal capability of establishing administrative citation process, but the conclusion is that it's not without some measured risk in doing so, either pursuant to a legal challenge or legislative change to prevent that from happening. So it's an open question, but there appears to be the legal ability to head down that road.
At this time, no other city has actually taken that step?
Other than the one that the mayor just mentioned in terms of the city of Newman, whether I haven't seen what they've officially done, but the news article that he refers to, I pulled up here, does seem to indicate that they're going down that road. And there's been some indication that the city of Roseville in Northern California has done that, but they do not also have a red light traffic camera violations in their city. They were using it for other sorts of vehicular traffic violations, but not red light violations.
Thank you. I appreciate the update.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. And I appreciate the focus. That really is what the focus is. And a little bit more on Newman, Chief. What they actually did, I'm sure you'll be reading the article, they went beyond red light cameras. They went to every violation, giving the officer the option of giving you a DMV citation or one's going to go to state, or giving maybe someone a break because it wasn't quite so vagrant about a violation and doing an administrative citation. So they have the ability to do it on all violations. And I'm not saying that's something you would want to look at. I'm just happy we know we have the right to do this, and it just could be a, I just truly feel that I think the state of California, when they keep passing legislation to add enhancements on these tickets, it's a revenue thing. They are, and they can name it anything they want to name it, a fund to build new, state libraries or state parks, whatever you want to call it, it's a tax. So over and above what the legislature set as a $130 bail, everything above that is a tax. So that additional $400, whatever the dollars are, it's a tax on every one of us. There's some court costs involved, some money goes to the county, but not a lot. Mainly this is state tax. And I would like to finish up, if I can, by saying, reminding everyone, there are a lot of studies out here on this thing. I mean, we've only been doing this for 5 months. These things started in the early, 2002 to 2003. So a lot of these studies from the different AAAs and institutes and government agencies have come because they've been going down this road for a long time. So some of these studies actually have some benefit to look at because they've got a head start on us. Our discussions up here today, not to get back on red lights, wrong or right, but there's a lot of history there, and a lot of states have taken action, legislatures, to cap these things at a certain rate. And back on Karen, the thing about the rate of the fine, I just want to say I don't believe it's our role, especially in local government, to be involved in making a decision on what someone should be fined, other than the fact if we can make this less expensive. You know what I'm saying? Like, we shouldn't be involved in the punishment. How do we punish people? We can't legislate morality. We can't legislate, laws up here. We're local government. I think this is something
I said it's a consequence.
Right. I know, but that's a consequence, whatever. I know that's right, but that's not our role. I think we just have to look at what's best for the community. If we can make this a less of a financial burden on our community, so unless there's any closing comments, okay, we'll blow this joint. Thank you, everyone, for participating.